I am Plata on the line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. David Moskrop joins me now. He has just published a new book, Too Dumb for Democracy, Why We Make Bad Political Decisions and How We Can Make Better Ones. It's an engaging book that looks at where we are, especially with the myriad crises around us, environmental catastrophes, terrorism, the decline of democracy, not to mention Trump, Brexit, and Ford Nation. David writes about how we might tackle these daunting challenges, but also looks at our psychology, seemingly a challenge itself to addressing the urgent trials around us. It's eminently readable, often fun, and awfully thought-provoking. David Moskrop is a political theorist and commentator who holds a Ph.D. in political science. When he was out here in this part of the world, he was a frequent commentator on radio and television and continues his punditry and analysis from Ottawa, where he is doing postdoc work at the University of Ottawa. His Twitter handle is at David_Moskrop. This new book is published by Goose Lane. He joined me from Ottawa earlier this week. Please welcome to the Plant Health Line program, David Moskrop. Dr. Moskrop, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
So when you, in the title of the book, if you ask the question that we're too dumb for democracy, I mean, for people listening to us, I take it to mean that you mean us, the citizen. But I mean, what about the decision maker? What about the politician themselves? Are they prone to being dumb for the system at times?
Well, the good news is the principle is democratic. It applies to everybody. It isn't a function of being a citizen or bad political decisions aren't a function of being a citizen. They're not a function of being a politician. They're a function of being a human being. And so, you know, every person who is a human being alive at this moment is prone to making bad political decisions. So we're in this together.
Yeah, it just seems that a lot of politicians have gamed it, that they can sort of, that they're outsmarting the system, if you will, at times. But that goes to another part of the book where you talk about our institutions and whether they've been corrupted as they have.
Yes, I mean, you know, one of the top line arguments in the book is that the reason we make bad political decisions, which I define as not rational or autonomous, is because our psychology gets exploited or hijacked, and so, you know, that is used by those who have no interest in us making good political decisions to try to reach their end. And more generally, our institutions and our environments are inhospitable to good political decision-making, in part because of how fast things are happening, how much information is flying at us from all over the place, how tired we get, how many things we have to do day-to-day, and how few incentives we have to actually sit down and try to make good political decisions.
So I guess the other question that one might have as they're starting the book is what is a bad political decision? And I guess there is a difference between knowing what's bad versus, say, what one disagrees with.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I'm always very pleased when I get this question because it's absolutely critical. And it's tempting to say a bad political decision is any decision I disagree with, right?
Yeah.
And that's easy to do, but meaningless, because then someone comes along and says, well, I disagree.
Yeah.
And then you're nowhere. You've got nowhere to go from there. So I rely on process, and I define a good political decision as one that's rational and autonomous, by which I just mean rational in the sense that you should be able to collect information about the world that's true or accurate, factual, coherent, and when you make a decision, it should be autonomous, which is to say it should be supported by reasons that are true, that aren't the product of lies or self-delusion.
Now, when you talk about process, When a lot of people think that some of the institutions, not only in this country but in government, are broken, what's the remedy? I guess if we think that, well, I don't know. Just as an example, maybe the Attorney General shouldn't be in cabinet.
Yes. Well, and that's what's interesting is in the case of the Attorney General and the Minister of Justice role,
yeah,
being, you know, together or split, that one actually might get fixed. And it might get or addressed in a fairly appropriate way and maybe even quickly. So that might be an instance of where the institution actually, didn't work initially, but is going to be fixed in light of not working. We'll have to see. But more generally, you know, my critique of institutions is that they aren't inclusive enough. So, you know, if we're worried about the long-term health and viability of democracy, what we ought to be focused on is making sure that people trust our institutions, see them as fair, and have a chance to take part in them, so that they, you know, they don't think the system is fixed, and so that they can use these institutions, whether it's elections or the party system or citizens' assemblies or participatory budgeting or whatever it may be, to agenda set. Which is to say, to you know, get on the political agenda things that they think we should be talking about, and then get policies that they think are important for their lives. You know, it's tempting to say democracy is elections. You know, if you have free and fair elections, then you have democracy. But there's other elements to that, and one of those elements is you know, participatory institutions, and another one is policy representation. You know, is a country truly democratic if people don't get the policies they want, even if there are elections? I think not.
We'll talk about some of the remedies that you have in terms of how to be more for us to be more participatory, but you know, you're someone who comments regularly on political matters. How often can, say, an institution be fixed? I mean, how often does one see change, say, just in this country alone?
You know, usually institutions change over time. I mean, typically they sort of plod along based on however they've operated and until they reach some critical juncture that's come about for one reason or another, and then they sort of either change or die and get replaced. In Canada, our institutions actually do fairly well, and they change fairly slowly, but in ways that are broadly acceptable and productive. So we actually are closer to the healthy end of that than say, the United States, where, you know, democratic norms are in decline and institutions are a mess. You know, my argument in advancing the book is couched in a claim that democracy is globally in pretty bad shape, known as, for instance, democratic recession, and is vulnerable at home as well. And so, you know, some politicians who might have enlightened self-interest, like in preserving democracy and their own jobs, I look and say, well, we'd better be proactive. We'd better build in participatory elements now and double down on attempts to foster trust now, because while things are okay at the moment in Canada, there's no guarantee they will be in 5 or 10 or 20 years, so we'd better get on it right now.
And so what are some of the suggestions that you make in the book in terms of say, our democracy being more inclusive?
Well, I mean, I believe that we should adopt participatory mechanisms like citizens' assemblies, where ordinary citizens are randomly chosen to come in and help suggest policies, and participatory budgeting, again, where random citizens or citizens are chosen randomly to come in and take part setting budget priorities for a small percentage of the budget. These are old practices. They exist globally. They've been thought about and talked about for years, but they're critically important and increasingly so. And we should adopt these institutionally. We should make them fairly routine. That isn't to say that everyone should become a full-time politician. I don't want that, and I assume most people don't. We've got lives, and that's the whole point of democracy, is that you can go live your life.
Yeah.
But having a little bit more of that would be salutary, I think. And on top of that, though, we ought to support these institutions by making sure that we redistribute the resources necessary to make sure that everyone has a shot to participate in them in a meaningful way.
Some people might think, David, that participating, say, on Twitter or on social media is a good thing, and because a lot of people tweet now and a lot of people post on Facebook about political matters, that's enough. And I guess the coming out of that is, I mean, how does one engage another person or other people online better? I mean, you're someone who uses Twitter a lot, and you've seen this from both sides in terms of it can be quite engaging and useful, and at the other times it just can be, you know, a shit show.
Oh, yeah, and I mean, I'm sort of guilty of both of those myself, and I think most people are. You know, the Internet and social media were meant to be these democratizing, leveling tools. And some of the early research into them suggested that what might have been happening was actually they were being used disproportionately by the already powerful to sort of consolidate power, just another tool in their toolkit. You know, it can be useful, but we've got to be careful because it can also be deleterious. So, you know, trying to apply rules like slowing things down finding useful sources you trust, thinking about something before you say it,
yeah.
Defaulting to being perhaps a little bit generous of spirit. These are all things that are useful in our broader lives, but I think are doubly important online. Otherwise, you encourage such a toxic environment that, you know, when you load on to that foreign interference, for instance, or strategic actors who want to make a mess for whatever reason it may be, to make money, to win an election, whatever, then you get into a lot of trouble really fast. So, I mean, it's a tool, but it's got to be used in the right way.
Now, the remorse over the referendum result over Brexit, you talk about that in the book, and the thinking of people, the voters in that referendum, is fascinating because a lot of people who voted to leave ended up, you know, wanting a do-over. And so,
yeah.
So what do you say as someone who looks at politics seriously and regularly to a portion of the population who don't?
I don't like referendums for the most part. I think they should be used very, very sparingly and judiciously. And then when they are used, ought to be designed very, very carefully. And if not, you get a mess. So, you know, what referendum will give you is a snapshot of a moment in time. But it's like saying, well, we're gonna decide who wins the World Series by playing a single ball game, and then you're stuck with that.
Mm.
Instead of trying to develop a deeper understanding or a central tendency or, you know, for instance, a pattern, right?
Yeah.
So that's the risk with referendums, and then you get locked into it. And they can also be gamed. And Brexit was a great example of how things were gamed. People were promised all kinds of things that weren't true. There was foreign interference. There was digital interference through trolls and botnets on Twitter, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, that's the risk in running these things. Now, compare that to a participatory mechanism like a citizens' assembly, which unfolds very, very slowly in very deliberate, careful institutional design settings. That tends to produce much better, more lasting, high-quality decisions.
Are you, because we're coming up to a federal election in the fall, how concerned are you about interference in that?
I'm quite concerned. I'm a little bit relieved to know that our elections are world-class. I mean, the fact that we have Elections Canada, which is world-renowned as a very competent electoral body, we have pencils and paper to vote on, not voting machines, and not online voting, thank God. That is encouraging as well. Now, the thing that will, if anything is going to get hacked, it's going to be our minds.
Mm.
And that's the thing to watch. So, I mean, I do think the election will be a target. We're developing a model as a country for what to do about that. You know, there is no international model right now. We're figuring it out in real time with everyone else. But we know a lot more today than we did in 2015, 2016, for instance, and sort of everyone's working together, some more productively than others, but everyone's working together to try to figure it out. And there's a general sense among government, the media, civil society, and even the tech platforms that we ought to be really, really careful and get it right. So I'm worried, but I'm not panicked because I do think we'll have a pretty good shot at resisting the worst of it.
One of the things I was thinking about as I was reading your book, Too Dumb for Democracy, was it seems to me that there's something different today than, say, a generation or two ago. Did something fundamentally change, or did we just take too long to notice, say?
Well, it depends on who you're focusing on. I mean, there was no golden age. Every generation has serious concerns. Whether it's the sort of anti-communist scare or it's, racial and gendered hatred and prejudice or, the sort of exclusion of a large section of folks from democratic life. There's always something. Or, collusion because politics was corrupt. I mean, politics, for instance, is far less corrupt today than it was 100 years ago, right?
Mm.
Just, it's night and day. One thing that might be changing is that there are sort of erosion of norms that might have peaked in previous decades, especially in the United States, so that things are back on the register, bad tactics, bad, nasty strategies, hate-filled nonsense, the rise of sort of extremism and so on and so forth, but that's creeping back on. One of the things I try to get to in the book is this idea that
the history of democracy is the history of its rise and its decline. You know, it's not like you achieve democracy and once you get it, the achievement's unlocked and it's there permanently. It's something that needs to be reborn every generation through commitments to trust, inclusion, and representation, because otherwise you can lose it. And I think that, you know, so thinking about it in terms of sort of renewal, birth and decay, for instance, is useful because it allows us to get this idea that, oh boy, we'd better protect this, because if not, we might lose it.
And so if we're in a valley, I mean, you referenced the democracy recession, I should say. Mm-hmm. If we're in a valley, do you see a peak shortly? And where might that happen?
Well, I mean, we'll see what happens as a pushback to what we're seeing globally. You know, the decline of democracy is in part driven by the decline of post-Soviet states. Back into away from liberal democracy and towards sort of authoritarianism or what's known as illiberal democracy, which is sort of like, you know, elections but not much else, and even then elections that are sort of dodgy. You know, now there is some worry that what we call sort of consolidated democracies or old democracies, the United Kingdom, the United States, Canada, might also be exhibiting some disconcerting signs. Now that's something to watch very, very closely. There could be a pushback to save it, to say, look, no, we've worked too hard. We've earned too much to let this go. So we're not going to sort of go gently into that good night. What we're going to do is double down on democracy. You're seeing some of that in the United States in reaction to Donald Trump, for instance,
mm-hmm.
And in the United Kingdom in reaction to Brexit. So there is some hope that people will look around and say, no, we're not going to stand for this falling apart. We're going to push back, and that was what the book was about. You know, it was about laying out a program, as well as an assessment of what was wrong, but also a program for doing better. And you know, the response to the book has been very, very encouraging and good. And if that's an indication of anything, then I'm hopeful.
You start the book by talking about your own worries. I mean, you started the book at a time where Trump had just gotten elected, I guess, and through the Brexit exercise. Have you, after finishing the book, have you now, say, have some of those worries been allayed by, say, a bit of optimism, perhaps?
Well, I mean, I would call it hopeful or cautious optimism, buoyed by the resilience of some of our institutions, and the good faith of many people who really do care about this and want to do better. I certainly don't think we should throw in the towel. That said, you know, I think of climate change every day because that is going to be the greatest stress test on our institutions that we have ever had to bear. And extreme weather events, climate refugees, shortages of resources, et cetera, start to really ramp up, then it's going to be very, very difficult to maintain all of this because it'll really put democracy to the test. You know, democracy in part gets to keep going because people are generally satisfied with things. What happens when the worst of climate change starts to hit? That's going to be the real test. That's part of the reason I think that we should be optimistic and hopeful, and certainly should talk about things in optimistic and hopeful ways because that's productive. You know, we should be very, very serious about how real that challenge is. And should double down or triple down or quadruple our efforts to address, you know, battening down the hatches and protecting our institutions now. Because, again, if not, when that starts to hit, it could blow it all out to sea, so to speak.
Yeah. What? How have you been, though, in terms of your own thinking, especially when because you talk about this in the book, that you were a bit of a partisan early in your life. How are you in terms of now dealing with people that disagree with you?
I mean, I hope I'm better. I mean, I try to live by what I talk about in the book. And I found that in recent years I do things like change my mind more than I used to, admit that I'm wrong more than I used to, catch myself, slipping into biases like availability bias, you know, just going with what's off the top of your head, or or likability, which is, you know, sort of wanting to side with people you like against people you don't like. Mm-hmm. I'm better at catching that stuff. And that's one of the great takeaways from not just my book, but any book that talks about political psychology and, you know, mental shortcuts and that sort of thing, is that once you become aware that these things exist, it gives you a tool for addressing them. And we can get better. You know, we're not perfectible, but we can certainly do better instead of worse. So, that's encouraging, and it's certainly a standard that I try to apply to myself.
Now, the way you've written the book is awfully engaging. It's often witty. Where do you glean inspiration in the course of your writing, not just this book, but the other things that you've written and through your commentary in the public sphere on radio, television, and in the media? Is there a way that you've approached how you've talked to the public, say, over the years?
You know, I try to be as accessible as possible. You know, if you're going to write about democracy and politics, you know, you'd better be accessible. I'm amazed at the number of people who write about democracy who just can't utterly be understood by anyone, let alone the public at large. So it's something I pay close attention to. I've adopted this idea that if you're going to write for the public, then you'd better write for the public. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, when I was writing for Policy Options, when Dan Gardner was there, he would say to us, you know, write for your neighbor, the dentist, you know, mm-hmm. sort of educated but non-expert. I mean, I think if everyone who writes about this stuff or talks about it can adopt a standard of sort of writing for their mom or their uncle, or, you know, or their friend who is an accountant or whatever it may be, then it gives you a sort of frame of reference, which I find helpful. And then I would add to that, there's nothing wrong with trying to be engaging and enjoyable, because you can learn while also enjoying yourself. I mean, that's there's nothing wrong with that. You know, there's some folks who are worried about that because they don't want to seem unserious. But I find it's worth trading a little bit of that off if you can be engaging.
Now, you follow politics closely, and you know, as I've alluded to already, you know, we've heard and seen you out here in Vancouver regularly over the years. Also, people in you know, who watch the national shows follow you there. And I've always wondered this. You often get frustrated by politics. Do you ever get bored by it?
No, I don't. It's amazing. I don't. And I think it's because, believe it or not, I take very long breaks where I will sort of slip into playing video games or watching bad television or reading Raymond Chandler or, you know, or Game of Thrones or Harry Potter or whatever it may be. You know, I'll do these sort of 800-meter dash or runs into politics, and then I'll do, you know, 100-meter dashes for something else. And I found it's a pace that has been sustainable for the last, well, the last couple of years anyway. I mean, I think it'll be permanently sustainable, but who knows? Yeah. But I mean, I'm very much committed to this idea that, you know, politics is central to our lives. We ought to be dialed in. But, you know, politics exists to enable us to do things that aren't political too, right? Because otherwise, what's the point of life?
Now, you're flogging this book, and I'm speaking. You're in Ottawa as I'm speaking to you. You're coming out to Vancouver. I'm talking to you earlier in the week, and so you're coming out midweek here. And you've done a lot of interviews already on the book. How do you keep your energy up on a book tour like this?
Oh, that's a great question. I don't think you do. I think you just power through. I've done. There's a lot of travel with this, a lot of interviews. You talk about it sort of every day, lots of text messages and emails and tweets and Facebook posts and the rest of it. You just let it wash over you. I'm going to take the month of June off, and so I'm going to go travel in North Africa and here and there. So it helps to have something unrelated to look forward to.
Yeah.
But the other thing is this. It's just a wildly exciting and privileged thing to be able to do, and so I'm still sort of riding the high of the fact that I was able to put something out into the world that takes up space that people are spending their time reading and talking about, and that's a special feeling, and it's meant a lot for me, so that helps get me through the day.
So when you go to Northern Africa shortly, are you able then to, say, turn off your phone and not check in every day or every hour in terms of what's in the news?
Oh, yes. yep, I say goodbye to social media. I turn the phone off. I grab some video games I like, and, you know, that I do a little of that in the morning and go explore cities in the afternoon and then out to the town in the evening, and I don't even think about it. What's interesting is that, you know, during day-to-day, week-to-week, when I'm working, it's sort of all I think about.
Mm.
And then when I turn it off, I don't think about it at all. I just go do other things, just like I used to years before I had a phone or Facebook or Twitter or any of it. Which is nice. You know, a month of that gets you through 11 months of the rest of it.
Yeah. Let's say, David, you've got $100 burning in your pocket, $100, $150. What, you want to buy, say, a good scotch, what would you go pick up, say?
Well, I'll give you two options. If you like the smoky, peaty stuff, then you can't beat the Lagavulin 16.
There you go.
And if you like the sort of honey and sunshine in a glass, then you can't beat the Balvenie.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of my favorites. Actually, two of my favorites, now that I think about it. I guess you are relied upon in terms of not just your friends, but people on Twitter for advice on scotch, right?
Yeah, I am, and that's about. I'm as honored about that as I am about anything, to be honest. I've just recently hit. I'm just sort of looking over at my shelf.
Yeah.
I think 45 bottles on my shelf these days. So if anyone ever wants to come over and help me deal with that, then there's plenty. There's plenty in the hopper.
Did you have to haul that all the way from Vancouver to Ottawa?
Joe, I believe that's against the law. I would never.
As I've told you, I don't know if I've ever told you this, but I'm a great admirer of your work and a great fan, obviously, having seen you out in this part of the world for the last couple of years and have enjoyed this book. Congratulations on it. I appreciate your time today.
Oh, that's so kind of you to say. Thank you so much. And I'm pleased that you're able to, that you welcomed me on.
The book is Too Dumb for Democracy: Why We Make Bad Political Decisions and How We Can Make Better Ones. It's published by Goose Lane. David Moskrop joined me on the line from Ottawa. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Plante.